All right, here's the 5 at 5 brought to you by Duplicating Systems, more than a system, a solution. Jeff, on the subject of the NFL draft, which we talked about a little bit yesterday, that some group of GMs actually submitted, like, hey, we need to postpone the draft because we can't adequately prepare for it. We don't have enough time to really get in there, evaluate these guys, blah, 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 blah. Well, the commissioner has put his foot down and said, we're having the draft when it's scheduled. It will be different. It won't be held in Vegas. It'll be more of a studio show, but we're going to have the draft. You know, there's not going to be players there or anything. There's going to be a draft, and if you say anything negative about it, there will be repercussions.
You hear that, Herb Street?
But, yeah, someone should get to him.
Jeez.
But so here's a thought that crossed my mind just to, you know, make Falcons fans feel a little bit worse about things now. Does this potentially, like, if the Falcons screw up the draft again, can Quinn and Dimitroff say, hey, I mean, look, we had one hand tied behind our back because we couldn't really do the full evaluations that we wanted to do. And kindly Mr. Blank would say, you know what, they've got a point. So we're going to keep them for another year now.
Well, and here's the deal. Even when they've had time to get full evaluations, they really haven't drafted all that well. I'm stunned that those two guys are back.
Well, I am too. I mean, I'm stunned that Dan Quinn made it through the off week last year when the team was 1-7.
Wasn't it? You're the first one who brought it up. You're ahead of the game, as usual. When Ron Rivera was let go by the Panthers before, because Quinn's still there. And at that point, then Atlanta won a couple of those quote-unquote meaningless games, although they were meaningful. It cost them a better draft choice. And I just remember that the more time went by, you kept saying, I'm not so sure he's out of here. And that what really stunned me, too, was when you've had a second straight just highly disappointing season, so much so that even my stupid self still had them in the playoffs for 7 in, 5 out, 2 years in a row, and got burned. Fool me twice. We all know that saying. And so you got to, all right, it's either the coaching, they've got the players, they're not being prepared right, or if you're going to keep the coach, you just say, well, he hasn't been given the proper talent. And I don't see any way you keep both, but they did.
Yeah, I mean, I thought all along, like, if one of them went, it was going to be Quinn. Dimitroff is coming back because I think you could have he could have passed the buck on some of those drafts to we were doing what Dan Quinn wanted. He came here to build this defense, so I kept taking guys he wanted me to take. And that even going back to the Vic Beasley draft, when a lot of Falcons fans wish they would have taken Todd Gurley, but nope, Dan Quinn wanted Vic Beasley because we're, you know, building the Legion of Boom in that defense. And so I feel like Dimitroff was always coming back. Quinn was the one that was the question mark. But when they didn't fire him during the off week, when they were 1-7, as the season kept going on, you felt like that was the case. But the Panthers got it right, because if you leave your coach in place, then that guy obviously is going to keep trying to win.
For sure.
Whereas the Panthers are just like, we're a lame duck staff now, so what do we care? And they kept losing. But three of those wins the Falcons had down the stretch, two of them were against Kyle Allen and the Panthers, and then they beat Gardner Minshew and the Jaguars. So, you know, you put some perspective on there of like, boy, the team really got hot at the end of the year. Like, all right, they beat Kyle Allen twice, Gardner Minshew once, and, you know, they got that win at San Francisco, that fluky win.
Well, and the 49ers had 6 defensive starters sit out that game.
Yes.
They were hurt.
And, you know, then they beat famous Jameis on a pick 6 to end the season.
That's right.
And that was it. So, yeah, all right, they won 4 in a row, but, you know, I mean, let's look at some of the quarterbacks they were facing on the other side of that.
Well, that's kind of the thing you see in baseball a lot. It's, you know, I've seen it at the collegiate level before, especially. Well, there's a guy who doesn't start much against SEC pitching, and he comes in. Hey, you know, this guy's hitting 300. Yeah, he's 3 for 10. He's come in, and not saying that's not good, but, you know, he's come in the second half of midweek games against their B pitching.
Yeah, but this is like a big time, you know, potentially now a mulligan season.
Oh, big time.
You know, for teams that might end up where you look back on it, well, that draft was dreadful. Well, hey, look, I mean, we couldn't fully evaluate these guys. And I wonder even how, when you think about it in college football, coaches on the hot seat, is it a mulligan season? And like, let's start with Muschamp at South Carolina. You know, it's like, well, you know what? We're disappointed in the results, but we wanted to be better. You know, but you know what? We didn't have any spring practice. It was tough in the offseason. You know, Mike Bobo's in. Mm-hmm. Although I think South Carolina is one of those teams that might have actually gotten a practice or two in. Not that that is substantial by any means, but it's still more than zero.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I wonder how, you know, things might operate with some athletic departments after the season when it comes to, you know, disappointing years of some coaches. Obviously, first-year coaches are going to be fine either way. But coaches that have been there a couple of years, if they don't have great years, if it's kind of now built in mulligan for them.
No, I think there's a good chance that could happen. But, you know, for some coaches, the leash is so short and the seat is so hot. It's you know, I think the argument will be made, well, this is when the great coaches really show. You had less time, so you're able to still go out there and prepare and put together a team that can win. I think in the end, if your coach is on the hot seat and he doesn't produce in college, especially, because let's face it, in college we all understand in the end that the presidents, the athletic directors, have a large say in it. But I think back to Gladiator when you know, you win the Coliseum, you win Rome. Fans make the decisions in college football. Let's cut to the chase.
That's true.
In the NFL.
And boosters.
Yes, fans, boosters.
Wealthy boosters.
Yes, in the NFL, it's, you know, fans have a big influence, the media does, but in the end, it's still the owner's decision. But, you know, I've felt, even, you know, for Coach Rick, for all the good things that he did here, I mean, after that Florida game his last season, I mean, if you took a referendum there, it was 90-10 on the flip side. I mean, that was – There was just too much pressure where I don't see any way Georgia could have kept him, especially when you had the South Carolina job open and everyone knew that Kirby was their first choice there. And it was like, there ain't no way we can let one of our guys go over there and start beating us. So it was kind of that storm when everything came together. But we could feel it. You and I talked about it. I mean, it was obviously getting down towards the end. I think Coach Rick was tired. As we've said, it was a great divorce for both sides there. And just that night of the Florida game, with whatever in the world we were doing with Fatone Bauta that day, the vast majority of the Georgia populace had made up their mind, even those that were 50-50. That was the tipping point there. And there was no way any administrator in any position within the university could have saved him at that point.
Yeah, I thought even that was a kind of an indication, too, that maybe Coach Rick had burned out a little bit at the time.
Sure.
Which he said he had, but then, you know, the Miami job came open, and I'm like, all right, well, I'll take this job then at my alma mater.
I wish for him, I really wish he would have sat out for a year to fully recharge the batteries. And I know that first year at Miami turned out to be a good one, but you know, to really get it back, because I get it. And listen, these guys are very well paid, and nobody's playing the violin for them. But it is extraordinarily high stress. And especially, I mean, when you think about the social media, Chris, you and I talk about this a lot. Big picture here, the recruiting game, I mean, it's 24/7, 365. You know, when you got kids announcing their top 10s, you know, you got to tweet at them, you got to text them, and this goes for every school. Just the burnout factor, I think, is going to be much greater for every coach out there, because it really is 365 days a year now.
Yeah, that's why I've said, even when you think about these games that have been scheduled for like a decade down the road, like, I, to me, like, even for Georgia with Kirby, it's probably at best 50-50 that he's even coaching some of those games at that point. And it's not because he's going to be terrible and get fired, but it's just, he might just get burned out. I mean, it's still, that's a, in this day and age, you just don't have those Bear Bryants that coaching one, Coach Dooley's had coached somewhere for a quarter of a century. It's, you start to get around 10, 11, 12 years, and it's like, that's a really long time now.
It really is. And, you know, so I think Saban is in his, this will be what, his 14th at Alabama. And, you know, for Kirby, I interviewed him between the 2018 SEC championship game and the Sugar Bowl against Texas. And just brought up, you know, we hadn't played these guys in a long time, but it's great. I'm excited about the schedule, that they're going to be on the schedule down the road. And he said, hey, I hope I'm around coaching the team then. And so, you know, I think we've got a unique situation in that this is home for both Kirby and Mary Beth. So he wants to be here forever. So for him, maybe he looks at Saban and says, hey, good gosh, if I could go to, let's see, his first year was 2016. If he could get to 2030, that would give him 15 years. And, you know, I would think 15 years now compared to 25 years in the 70s and 80s would probably be equivalent. I mean, it was a really tough job back then, but it's just a completely different animal now. And I just think with what's happened with the social media and the 365-day recruiting cycle has been the biggest change, because and there is still some downtime, which is good. There's some time in May. There's some time between the February signing date and spring practice. There's some time in the summer when these coaches can get away. But when that practice starts into July 1st of August through the season, through the bowl, and especially now with the early signing day, and if you play in a conference title game, that's the busiest time of year. So you take that through the second signing day. I mean, you're talking about basically 6 months straight where it is just relentless. And that will wear down even the best and most intense and sharpest and brightest of coaches. And that's where Kirby is really good about when they do have time, and he and Mary Beth and the three kids, they take advantage of that, and they get away. You have absolutely got to do it to recharge those batteries. I mean, I just think now, Chris, like we talk so much, just going back to that period between the conference title game and the early signing period. I mean, what was it last year, like 12 days?
Yeah, you know, in this day and age, too, it's probably easier to sit back and say, like, why do I keep grinding constantly? Because the money is so much greater than what Coach Hughes used to have. So it's like, well, I got to keep making a living, so I got to keep going at it. But now it's just, you know, you're making, you know, these top-end coaches are making like $7, $8 million a year, that at some point you could say, like, you know, I think I've got enough now. I'm good.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, for a lot of these guys, there's always that parachute of television. Or, again, what I've always said, and kind of when Mike Krzyzewski conveniently took that year off after going to the Final Four for the seventh time in 9 years, and he had Grant Hill as a senior in 1994. His back flared up in 1995, and I don't blame him. But he basically recharged the batteries that year. And I always said this, if I'd been in Jeremy Foley's shoes after Urban Meyer, quote-unquote, retired in 2010, maybe for fun we can go back and read those quotes, if that would be insulting to imagine him wearing another school's colors other than the orange and blue. To me, the play there is like, listen, you just sit for a year, stay with us. We're gonna go with an interim coach. I think you'll get, as Coach Dooley used to say, that fire in the belly again. And then lo and behold, you know, by October, I mean, and the way things worked out with Tressel, I mean, that was just a perfect fit with Luke Fickell sitting there at Ohio State. I mean, he was foaming at the mouth for that job by October.
Well, and Urban Meyer's one of those guys, too, talking about the parachute of television. He did that for...
So he's done it twice.
Yeah,
now,
for the year in between, and now he's back at it again. And it really opened up for Tony Romo.
Oh, my gosh. He was a very good quarterback, but he is... Man, he's like Roger Staubach and John Elway combined on TV.
I think the money he's getting paid now by CBS is I think more than he ever made in a season playing for the Cowboys.
I mean, you think about that $17 million for a year, Chris. I mean, it's going to take the two of us 5 years to make that.
I know, right? And I know now Peyton, I believe, turned down ESPN. I don't think he's going to take their offer to be on the Monday Night Football crew.
I think Peyton, he is really good with those comedic bits. I mean, if he had the right – I mean, like, I could see – I don't know if he'd want to do it every day. I mean, I could see him being in a couple of movies, or maybe, you know, being kind of a guest star on a sitcom or something. I mean, he's sharp with that stuff.
Well, he's been great when he's hosted Saturday Night Live. He's in those commercials with that country music singer.
Yes. Is it Brad Paisley? Is that who that is?
Is it like an insurance or something?
Yeah, those. It's the Nationwide. They're fantastic.
That's it. Yeah, but yeah, he's good in those.
He's really good.
Like he knows how to deliver lines, and that's a big part of comedy is the timing. You know,
it's the timing.
You can have a funny joke, but it's all sometimes in the way you deliver it.
It's all about the delivery. And I mean, when he did the one Saturday Night Live, basically, you know, when he drills the one kid with a fastball pitch, and what he's showing him how to boost a stereo from a car.
It's like a United Way commercial,
right? Yeah. Right. I mean, it's fantastic. So, I mean, I could see Peyton going more towards the entertainment end of things.
All right, moving on in the 5 at 5, talking about sports getting going again and the potential of playing some of these games maybe without fans. Rank for me sports that would be from like best to worst as far as a viewer on TV that would be fine, no problem watching without fans actually at the venue, to like, boy, this is kind of weird to even watch when you don't have any spectators there.
I think the oddest for me would be not having college football with fans. And for those of us who watch some of the SEC and the college football 150 stuff, they talked about Rune Arledge and a couple of his proteges and how, like, listen, we're going to show college football. It's not just the game. We're going to show the band. We're going to show the fans. We're going to show the cheerleaders. We're going to get the pageantry in there. I cannot imagine that. Basketball, you know, it'd be tough for any sport. Basketball and hockey, I think you can at least – it's played on a smaller playing surface. So it's almost like you could zero in on that a little bit. And even in the NFL, you know, where the halftime's so short, I mean, you know, when you see that third quarter kickoff, the stands are like 70% empty, right?
Yeah, they're stuck in concessions.
Yeah, everybody's stuck in concessions and going to the bathroom. And we've seen some baseball games, you know, hey, the Braves have been victims, certainly the Marlins, where there's nobody there. So I kind of think college football would be the toughest pill to swallow there. And then probably golf would be next. That would look really strange. Even if you were watching, say, Tiger and Brooks Koepka, if they said, all right, hey, listen, we're going to play the U.S. Open this year at Wing Foot, but there are going to be no fans. If it was Tiger and Brooks Koepka coming down to the 72nd hole all tied up and they both had 15-foot birdie putts, wouldn't it just kind of feel like, well, I'm just, you know, there's nobody there to roar. This is like, well, I'm just kind of watching two guys play their match at the club, right? I mean, and maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know.
There's no one to yell Baba Booey.
Baba Booey.
I think it would be weirdest though at Augusta, because that's part of lore of the Masters is the back nine roars.
Of course.
I think I could handle golf maybe anywhere else except Augusta. The easiest sport though, because I've watched dozens of tennis matches where there are like, you know, five or six people in the crowd. Tennis would be the easiest one to pull off.
And I do think too, with tennis, basketball, and hockey, it might seem counterintuitive. They've got the smaller playing surfaces, so you can just really zero the cameras can just zero in on that.
Yeah, basketball I think would be tough though, because that one would be another one where you just feel like you're watching two teams scrimmage.
I'll say this though, I think it'd be easier to watch the NBA with no fans in college, because if you think about March Madness, you know, a Kentucky Louisville game and the fans behind the basket aren't waving their arms for the other team to miss the free throw, that would be odd.
Like the first couple rounds of the NCAA tournament would have been fine, because a lot of those aren't really heavily attended.
Well, and you've got, you know, you just got, because you've got four games in a day, so very few people are going to sit there and watch all four games. You're
right.
Only going to go watch your team. You're exactly right.
But these are the ones that would have been like,
oh, yeah.
Like if they had the Final Four in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium and it was empty.
Bad luck.
Yeah, I almost think if they had somehow been able to to continue and hold the tournament, they would probably have had to have changed it and at least played it at Phillips Arena or maybe even at Tech. Who knows?
Yeah,
they couldn't have done it in there.
Because one of the things, too, I think the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight games are, in general, are usually better because they are generally played, not all the time, there have been some played in domes, but they're generally played in basketball arenas. So you've got the familiar, you've got the shooting backgrounds, you got the fans down there close to the court, right behind the basket. Obviously, a basketball arena, it's more organic as opposed to when you get to the domes. So that would have been, I mean, can you imagine playing there, like you said, in front of a 70,000-seat stadium with nobody there, but also, and I'm not sure where all the regionals were this year, but let's just say, you know, you're in
I know one of them was in, it would have been in Madison Square Garden.
There you go. So Madison Square Garden or Freedom Hall. You know, you got 20,000 people there, and there's nobody in there.
Yeah.
I think, like you said, it looked like a scrimmage.
Yeah. I think the West was at Staples Center. That would have been in L.A.
Very odd.
But, yeah, I mean, I think basketball would be tough. Hockey would be fine because you can really kind of, like, zone in on the ice. Yeah, I mean, you'd miss maybe like people banging on the glass in a few spots.
Oh, that's beautiful. Just like you watch like a Bruins Flyers game when a guy gets checked right into the boards.
Yeah.
Not for the faint of heart.
I think I could, other than the Masters, I think I could handle golf because I've woken up sometimes on Saturday mornings and I'll turn on the golf channel and they'll be showing a European tour event. Like there's no one there. And it's I don't know, and it's fine, and I get it. I mean, the European Tour, there aren't any scenarios like you're talking about where you've got Koepka and Tiger, and there might be dueling, where, you know, then you've got the scene where they're walking up to the 72nd hole and tipping their caps and all that. It would be strange, but I feel like that we had – wasn't there a U.S. Open that ended on a Monday one time, and there was some bad weather, so they didn't let anyone in? Because I always remember, I think K.J. Choi – would or you know, like the golfers were like tipping their cap after they made putts, but like no one was there, and it was just kind of funny that they kept acknowledging people and waving after they made shots.
I don't think it was a major, but it might have been like maybe the tournament in San Diego one year, and it was just like a friends and family, and they had to start it very early, like 8 a.m. Pacific. And there was literally nobody out there. I know what you're talking about.
Because they had a bunch of wind that blew a bunch of stuff over.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It was for whatever reason, San Diego comes to mind. I might be wrong on that. But, yeah, that's – so. And isn't that funny for those guys? Even though there's nobody there, it's just still – it's your natural reaction to go ahead and tip the cap.
Yeah, and, like, wave. Because even, like, if a guy comes off, he makes a quadruple bogey. When the ball goes in, it's like, yeah, all right, yeah, okay. I'll show it to you.
Good job.
All right, there's the 5 at 5 brought to you by Duplicating Systems, more than a system, a solution.